Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from Elator and Ford Motor Company versus Tyson. Justice Hankinson is not sitting in this case.
May it please the court. This is a mandamus proceeding arising out of the imposition of severe sanctions for alleged state abuse. The sanctions range from exclusion of evidence that goes to the very heart of the case to a $10 million
We don't really need to talk about that anymore, do we?
No, we don't.
No, there's not any kind of cross-mandamus that should be restored.
That's right. But the original sanction order was $10 million. And also, an award of appellate attorney's fees, particularly for challenging the order, when moved to draw on appeal. The underlying case is the product liability action arising out of the 1991 car accident. And the sanctions controversy centered over a document that we describe in our papers as the Kent Report. Now, Kent was an engineer hired by State Farm. State Farm was the plaintiff's liability insurance carrier to go out and investigate the cause of the crash right after it happened. State Farm is not involved in this case. It's never been involved in any way in the action against Ford. Now, how Ford initially received a copy of that Kent Report is really not in dispute. An investigator working for Ford's lawyer called the State Farm adjuster on the phone, identified himself as a Ford representative working on this very case, and asked for a copy. The adjuster consulted with her supervisor, got back with the investigator, and said, State Farm would be happy to give you a copy, but we'd like to recoup some of the $6,000 fee we paid to the engineering firm to do the report. Ford agreed to pay $500, and State Farm gave Ford a copy.
And that was
during the time that
It was during the time that the Rule 11 agreement was in effect. The Rule 11 agreement was entered into in October 93, and after the plaintiffs served their initial discovery requests on Ford. Then lawyers got together and said, we don't have to answer your discovery, we won't serve discovery, so we'd have a chance to talk to them. Look who was in the head, that got unwound, and the settlement talks happened in March 94, and that got unwound at the end of March. Phone calls to State Farm and received the Kent report happened at the end of February. So yes, it was during the time of that letter. But I'd like to emphasize that number one, that there's the testimony of the record from the lawyer to negotiate that agreement that all it was meant to do is you don't answer my discovery and I won't serve any on you. You didn't have anything to do with third party discovery. But more important, that wasn't discovered. That was an investigation of the claim at the time. That wasn't a discovery request that served on State Farm or served on anybody.
And the report was obtained one day before the motion to quash was filed.
That's right.
No dispute about that.
I don't know if there's a dispute about that or not. The Court of Appeals said in its opinion that the motion to quash was filed on the same day we received the report. And if you look at this, and what the facts are, is we received the report, the Court received the report, on March the 2nd at 8:45 in the morning. So I'm confident that that's the first thing that happened that day. The motion to quash, the certificate of service on it is dated the 2nd, but the letter by which it was served, cover letter saying closed, please buy plaintiff's motion to quash, is dated March 3rd.
And when did you receive it?
Ford received it on the 7th. Ford's lawyer received it on March the 7th.
Okay. Let me ask you this. If the document was obtained before the motion to quash was filed,
yes.
And if the document was obtained not in violation of Rule 11, is the only issue to focus on the issue of whether or not the document was privileged, or is there another issue to focus on?
I think the only issue is to focus on is whether the document is privileged. I mean, there's potentially an issue on whether Ford's obtaining the rest of the file, which happened 2 months after that, is that there was something wrong with that.
That's okay.
The rest of the file is not what we're all up here fighting about, really. The important thing is to get the court because of what it says.
Did the judge ever make any finding that because of obtaining the other file, because of the conduct with regard to the TRO, or because of any other action was the basis of excluding Kent's report?
Well, I don't know that the order is that clear. I mean, the order certainly recites those findings. Pardon?
I said I agree.
Yeah. I mean, the order recites those findings that the court abused the discovery process by, among other things, getting the TRO, which how that's discovered is not very clear either. But you know, by the way, obtaining the Kent report, by the way, obtaining the claim file. Plaintiffs, of course, relied on the cases that say in deciding what sanction to impose, the judge can think about all of the things that transpired in the case. So it's not clear for what alleged violation the exclusion was intended to answer. The reason the Kent report is so critical, let's take a minute on that, is because there are only two allegations in the underlying case. The plaintiff said the crash happened because either the brakes didn't work or because the cruise control was not disengaged. Kent's report got both of these theories. And for $6,000, State Farm got an expensive report. Kent spent several days on the car, took some of the components off, or looked up off the car, put it back on, tested it again. And his report concludes unequivocally that at the time of the crash, the brakes functioned properly, and that the cruise control would disengage properly at various speeds when you push the clutch or the brake pedal.
So it's your position that as of today, there would be no way that you could get an expert report that would support those same conclusions?
We have an expert report that supports those conclusions,
yes.
But it relies on a Kent report. Okay. Part of the sanction is that Ford's not only is the Kent report inadmissible, but none of Ford's witnesses, fact or expert, can rely on the Kent report in any way. It actually says directly or indirectly, meaning that the experts, we could have to count about the striking experts. I mean, they can't purge that from the mind. And worse, the sequence of events here, the crash was November 91, Kent looked at the car in December 91 and January 92. 2 years goes by before Ford gets a chance to look at the car. The case against Ford wasn't filed until the fall of 93, and then we first got to look at the car in early 94. And it's undisputed that by the time we got out there, the brakes didn't appear to work. And Kent looked at the car while it was still in State Farm's custody. He got down in January 92. In February 93, State Farm took custody of the vehicle over to plaintiff's counsel to maintain it the rest of the time. And like I said, by the time we got out there, the record says, we got in the car, pushed the pedal, and went straight to the floor. Not what happened in Kent custody.
And as it stands today, you are unaware of any other mechanical type of analysis that could be undertaken on the car to establish that the brakes didn't work or the cruise control didn't disengage?
That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct. And that's why the Kent report is so important. And that's why we believe that the motions for sanctions were filed. The motion for sanctions, again, there was one motion filed right after Ford got the whole file. That was back in 94 when the case was still pending in Harrison County. That was set for hearing that summer. The hearing was passed by agreement. And then 18 months went by where nothing happened. The rest of 94, all of 95, and the beginning of 96, Ford has the Kent report in the whole file. Plaintiff never saw an order requiring us to give it back or an order limiting our use of it. Then all of a sudden, March 96 comes along. They file another motion for sanctions. By this time, the case had been transferred to Dallas and signed Judge Tyson. And the motion for sanctions says that when Ford did get to test the car, it destructive testing, something wrong with our testing. And second, that we abused the discovery process, not by getting the Kent report in March, but by getting the whole file by subpoena in May 94. That's all the motion for sanctions. Nevertheless, we had the hearing. Judge Tyson, it was clear from her comment at the hearing and a long time before the hearing that she felt the Kent report, the whole file, was presumptively privileged. Anything in the insurance company file was subject to a privilege owned by the insured and inviolate, and that Ford acted improperly even by asking for the report in the first place. The Dallas Court of Appeals did not address the 5-2 board's conduct. Of course, as Judge Phillips intimated at the beginning, the Dallas Court of Appeals threw out the $10 million sanction for the court Tyson to vacate it and declined to review the remainder of our arguments, concluding that our remedy by appeal was adequate. We think the court got that wrong. Our verdict here, of course, are the same two problems. It showed that Judge Tyson abused her discretion, and it showed that our appellate remedy would be inadequate. The abuse of discretion, as Justice Abbott suggested, starts with the question of whether this document was privileged. Plaintiffs throughout there, and this is a legal conclusion, I should say, that Judge Tyson reached that under Walker is not entitled to the same deference. In factual determination. Throughout their papers, the plaintiffs say the privilege that was violated here is the insurer privilege. Well, of course, that's not in the rules anymore. So I'm trying to go through and decide what privilege they could even be applying to meet here. It can't be attorney-client, because there isn't any attorney involvement outside of all of the defense report. And if you look throughout the file, the only communications from the plaintiff's lawyers to State Farm were to the effect of, you don't need to be involved in this case against Ford. And that makes sense because the plaintiffs and their lawyers are adverse to State Farm. They have a claim pending against State Farm to this day, subject to a tolling agreement that extends limitations. So the idea that there could be privileged attorney-client communications between those two is totally unsupported by this. Same is true of attorney work problems. It can't be that privileged because there's no attorney involved, no mental presence, no legal privilege. What I think they're trying to is the investigative reported communication privilege. But by the very terms of that rule, it only applies in the case, the very case, in which the communications were made in anticipation of it. I say that very artfully. The rule says it only applies to communications made in connection with the prosecution, investigation, or defense of a particular suit or in anticipation of the prosecution or defense of the claim made part of the pending litigation. That means potentially there could have been a privilege if the Kent report was made by State Farm in anticipating the plaintiff's case against the board potentially. But the claim is just to testify unequivocally that was not.
I'm sorry, would you clarify that one more time? Are you saying that the claims adjuster testified unequivocally that the purpose of obtaining the report was not for any purpose related to this litigation?
Yes, absolutely. And that's actually set forth in the brief. The question was, let me not overstate it. I don't know that the question went to the witness was specifically to the Kent report. It went to the file. Did you prepare this file to assist the plaintiffs in their case against Ford? The answer was no. Later in the hearing, why did you prepare this file? What was the purpose of this claims file? Answer, two reasons. One, routine investigation of State Farm's coverage. We have a policy on the driver, a separate policy on the car, and we're trying to see what was implicated. Number two, potential liability claims against the driver. No evidence that there was any thought of helping the plaintiff intervene against the court. And again, the plaintiff's lawyers told him, we don't want your help. You are to stay out of the case against the court. So none of the privileges fit here. As a matter of law, for that reason, we say that Tyson abused her discretion in assessing any sanctions against Ford. Turning very quickly to the adequate remedy, all we have to do is look to Walker versus Packer. Walker versus Packer says that your appellate remedy will be adequate if the trial court's error vitiates or severely compromises your ability to present viable defense. The Court of Appeals didn't apply that test. It said, we can't tell that the Kent report is the only evidence relevant to your defense. Therefore, you have an adequate remedy by appeal. I think the only evidence test kind of gives effect to the court's word vitiated, but it ignores the rest of the phrase, severely compromised.
Can a CA decide that part of an order is technical by appeal and part of an order is not, and just kind of pick and choose which parts of an order it will set aside?
You know, I don't know the answer in terms of Kent, what its authority is. I don't think it's consistent at all with the policy behind the rule that you only get mandamus if your appellate is adequate. Reagan set forth two reasons why we require the legislature to meet that standard. It's that we don't want undue interference with the trial court's docket, and we don't want the appellate court's docket, overburdened. Well, in this instance, once the Court of Appeals decided to take the case, stay the underlying order, have briefs, hear oral arguments, consider the case, write an opinion, that took 9 months. So the trial court's docket was already interfered with, and the appellate court's docket was already burdened, and it wouldn't have been interfered with or burdened anymore to decide the whole case. So I don't think the adequate remedy by appeal prong should be enforced piecemeal. It ought to be assessed as to the whole order.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Texas Posada will bring the argument for respondent.
That attorney's fees are warranted and conditional on,
I believe it was unconditional. This court and breadth of the law, their checkbook generally, this was checkbook discovery. I do not agree that there are only two issues with regard to the Kent report. I think there are three issues. First of all, in the record, Ford then lawyer testified that he knew about the motion to quash on March 2nd. Not March 3rd, not March 7th. Record, he says, I knew about it on March 2nd. He says that in the record.
Let me ask you this. The report was obtained on March 2nd or 1st?
I believe it was obtained on March 2nd.
Do you know if the report was obtained before or after the attorney who testified knew about the motion to quash?
I cannot tell you about the record. I can tell you only that he says, I knew about it on the 2nd. I do not know if he heard about it that morning or the first thing when he got in. Immediately has to report back to the jury. But regardless, the next issue with regard to the Kent report is violation of Rule 11 agreement. And the third issue with regard to the Kent report is attempting to go around the motion to quash, sending out this full reporter virtually ex parte, then obtaining it in some sort of reasonable form. Those are the three issues with regard to the Kent report.
With regard, you don't claim it's privilege.
I do claim it's privilege. And those are the three procedural issues before we get to the privilege. That might be a better way to say it.
What privilege do you have? Are you assert?
I believe that's privilege in your investigative privilege, that is part of communication privilege, as well as a consultant expert privilege. Surely, there is a privilege that attaches to insurer's statement to their insurance carrier.
Whose is the privilege?
I believe it has to be the insurer.
Cohen's?
Is either going to be Cohen's or Archer's, because at this point in time, they're handling both files together.
Well, but they're adverse claims regards also, are they not?
They're potentially adverse at that point, but I don't know if they're actually adverse. It's not as if Cohen has sued Archer. At that point, State Farm thought that there might be some potential, but apparently did not believe that it was so significant that they needed to separate files. Or the record, they were still handling them together.
If we were to establish that as a rule and it were kind of applied across the board, would that mean that when an insured sues an insurance company for a breach of contract claim, that the claim file technically is the insured's and therefore can see everything that's in that file?
I don't think so. In fact, that's the second part of Justice Texas' question. I think that in some instances, the insurance company is going to own part of that. That is, if my insurance is going to sue me, I have the right to defend myself against it. At the same time, it can't be argued seriously that the insured has no interest in that. In fact, the National Tank Company versus Rutherford, this court was faced with NAPCO's investigation as well as the insurance company's investigation. And it's pretty clear that this court held that NAPCO was the proper party to enforce, to argue in favor of those who approved. And in this case, you clearly have investigative privilege, that is part of communication privilege, and they go out and they hire their own engineers to take a look at this. that context, I don't think that there's any serious dispute, but that the insured and the insurance company have an interest in those privileges. And I don't think that one can just up and waive the other services. And in fact, whenever Ford saw fit to sue the five-year-old, it was our firm who wound up representing her under the auspices of certainly the approval of State Farm. So in that context, we were clearly acting on behalf not only of the Archers and Cohen, but also on behalf of State Farm.
But that occurred after the report was obtained.
Absolutely. But I think that it speaks to the nature and ownership of the privilege and the relationship involved. But this court, I do not think, wants to get into drawing fine lines between maybe you anticipated that this party was going to sue you arising out of this transaction, or you did not foresee that that party was going to sue you and it's privileged as to this claim and not as that claim. I don't think that's the law under anticipation litigation. I don't think that's the law under party litigation.
But if we're going to have to draw that fine line either way we go, if we go your route, we still have to draw that fine line because under some circumstances, the insurance file maintained by the insurance company will arguably be that of the insured. But in other situations, especially when the insured wants to sue the insurance company, then it would be privileged for the insurance company to keep it from access by the insured.
But I don't think that's such a fine line between first-party insurance claims and third-party insurance claims. That is an eminently workable, that is an eminently reasonable test, and one that this court has adopted in the past.
What about third-party claims when there also could be a first-party claim?
This court expects it to have all the time. And there was often the tension between the good faith and fair dealing claim and the ongoing third-party claims. And this court had effectively walked the tightrope there and said that in some instances what you do, you wind up paying one part of the cost of action.
Let's parse away the insured and insurers. State Farm, under the facts of this case, would State Farm be able to claim that the research cause of this wreck was done in anticipation of the victim? Could they withstand a challenge to claim that the Kent report is a privileged document?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it is. I mean, the claim just testified that she had been contacted by an attorney under Section 13 with regard to a potential claim. On top of that, she testified that she was investigating for this particular claim. And in addition to that, on page 183 of the record, she testified that she was also concerned, or there was a possibility, I should say, that the truck who the Archers hit was going to wind up causing the lawsuit.
But that privilege applies to that particular litigation, and nobody brought any sort of claim like that against State Farm.
Well, it applies to that particular litigation, and this is that particular litigation. I don't think that the court has ever drawn a distinction that says, if you are involved in a multi-party wreck, and you anticipate suits 1, 2, and 3 and institute an investigation to defend yourself there, and you don't think about number 4, maybe it's the comp carrier, maybe it is some adverse party, maybe it is the landowner whose property damage, you injure, or property damage, and you didn't think about it. I don't think that if you are maintaining an investigation as to 1, 2, and 3, that this fourth one that you did not foresee immediately is somehow not privileged.
Isn't there some difference between being sued and suing, you know, in this situation?
Yeah.
I mean, Ford's not suing your... Ford's not suing its insured for messing up their cars.
No, but Ford certainly sued the insured for contribution and indemnity, both the child sleeping in the back seat and the grandparents.
But again, that lawsuit or claim was filed after they obtained the report.
But I don't know that post obtaining the report vitiates or somehow changes the nature of the underlying material. If it was privileged when it was created, then it was privileged when Ford bought and paid for it. And trial court would certainly within her discretion to rule and impose the sort of sanction that she did.
So if Ford had brought a subpoena against State Farm or State Farm's expert evaluation of this automobile, do you think under the state of the law on that work product privilege, State Farm would have prevailed in maintaining privilege on that document?
I don't think they would have prevailed on the work product. I think they would have prevailed under anticipation litigation and prior communication.
Under the circumstances we have in this case, would the necessity exception apply?
Potentially. Ford didn't bother to take that time. And that certainly speaks to the adequacy of appeal, the adequacy of the appeal. What Ford really wants is some sort of declaratory judgment from this court saying that they can use the support later on. All the trial, and I don't think that's proper use of mandamus. First of all, remember that all this evidence of that this is central and this is key and this is the heart and soul of our case, that was never presented to the trial court. In fact, this court is the first court that's ever been blessed with that information when it was filed in the affidavit accompanying the motion to the motion for leave to file.
Why is it abuse of the discovery process to request potentially privileged materials?
I don't know.
And obtain it.
I don't know that it is to request it. How you obtain it can certainly be an abuse of the discovery process.
Why is that?
If Ford had opened the window of State Farm, crawled in, filtered through the file, and taken it out.
I didn't do that. I was consent.
Yes.
If I ask you to show me your file regards a particular client, and you do it, have I committed discovery abuse?
I think that you have in some instances. For instance, if there is a Rule 11 agreement, second, if you then realize you can't use that report and go out and subpoena it and trump a motion to quash, as was done in this case, just because they have a test report doesn't necessarily do them any good. They don't have a form, they don't have a manner that you can try, they don't have a manner that their experts have reason to rely upon it. I think that there's going to be serious issues at the trial court level as to whether or not the Kemper report could ever come into evidence under Robinson and Dunn. I think that those are all issues that speak to whether or not there's an adequate work in the field.
Mr. Sala, would you talk about the Rule 11 agreement? Mr. Knight said all the agreement says is we're not going to serve interrogatories on the spot, but this was not, there was no agreement. They were not beyond that.
The Rule 11 agreement is in the record under the Act 26. I don't think it says we're agreeing not to send interrogatories. Apparently, Ford now claims that they view this as a one-way street. We, Ford, had received from Discovery, didn't want to respond to it, so we introduced this. But I don't think that's a fair reading of it, and that's certainly not the reading of that the trial court, the folks who actually, the judge who actually heard the testimony on it, gave it.
What length? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that there were significant issues as to whether or not the Rule 11 agreement was violated, and she was in the best position to tell that.
Specifically, what is your claim with regard to the agreement? How is that agreement violated?
I believe that the Rule 11 agreement was violated by sending out Discovery to State Farm issuing a subpoena. And that was clearly done prior to the time that the Rule 11 agreement was up. I don't know that paying for it, however nefarious and improper that is, I don't know that in and of itself technically violated the Rule 11 agreement. Frankly, the parties didn't contemplate that someone was going to go out and buy evidence in this case. So that wasn't part of the
buying a report that already existed. State Farm has a legitimate right to try to recoup $76,000 they paid.
I don't dispute that.
All right, so how can it be the fairest when they're trying to recoup $500 out of $6,000?
I think that any time a litigant seeks to get some information, that way.
The report's already done. Done deal. There was nothing to indicate the report was changed in any way, modified, altered, didn't anything deleted when got it. Is
it? You're absolutely right. And if the law is that litigants can go out and buy evidence from
buy
evidence, by witness statements, by photographs.
But you're implying that by buying, quote, buying a report that that's going to shade the conclusions. You're manufacturing something that doesn't exist. That the person who pays for it wants a specific result by their fact of paying for it. That's not this case.
I agree, and that's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that there is something wrong. I think that there should be something wrong with a law which says you can go out, talk with a party who is in privity with your opponent and buy evidence from that. Now, if that is not, if that is the law, if that is acceptable, doesn't this court should say so? I think that the ABA is a different field. I think the rules of discipline are essential for different rules of discipline.
That's right, but they're certainly set by public court.
Not at this time, because they were in privy, is what I meant to say. If you were buying the report, you're buying evidence from someone who was in privy.
Well, let me ask you this. Were they in privity with the party who they may sue?
They were both in privy with the party. They had both claims there.
I know, but you all had put on the back burner your lawsuit against them.
Right.
So does that make you in privy, your clients in privy with them, being that you were going to sue them?
I think so in this context. It is not unusual for a liability carrier to both defend and have to respond to a lawsuit. For instance, if there is an incident where someone is injured and that happens off premises, their homeowner's policy will be triggered. They may be sued for causing injury to the other person's property, and their homeowner's policy is going to have to defend them. At the same time, they may have an action against a third party for those injuries. And it's not at all uncommon in a liability context to have both an adverse relationship with your insured and a joint defense with your insured, as it's done here.
Let me ask you this about the Rule 11 agreement real quick, and I want to clarify my understanding of your understanding, and that is that obtaining the Kent report the way they did not violate the Rule 11 agreement, but what you say constituted a violation of the Rule 11 agreement was when they issued the notice to take the deposition of written questions.
I think that's a fair summary.
Okay.
I think that remember they get the Kent report two ways. One way violated the Rule 11 agreement explicitly, and one way did not. One way just violated the intent of the Rule 11 agreement.
Before it made
it
wrong,
I think that if the plaintiff had asked for it, it would have been made available to them. I can't tell from the record whether or not we actually had it in our possession. That's not clear to the record if we have a record.
Well, it shouldn't have been given to Archer, should it? Wouldn't that wait for instance?
I don't believe so, because it depends on, because at the time it was created, apparently they were still in hand on it with regard to State Farm's file.
Well, if Archer's going to sue Cole, is it Cohen's privilege or Archer's privilege? They're both entitled to it?
I think that you have to look to see how and why they go. In this case,
just say Archer sues Cohen. Is it privilege or not?
I think that between the two of them, it's not. I don't know that allows you to reveal to a third party. I mean, if one client is upset with another client, and they both have attorney-client privilege with the same lawyer, and there's a dispute there, I don't think that opens it up to everyone else. I don't think the entire world is entitled to that information. There is absolutely no reason why the exclusion of the Kent report, if that's what it comes down to, cannot be reviewed on the case. It may be that Ford gets another group of lawyers, gets their fifth or sixth group of lawyers, and decides not to introduce it at that time of trial. It may be that under Robinson versus Dobbert, or Robinson and Dobbert, that it is excluded. Maybe that it is cumulative. Ford claims to have evidence from Andrea Archer that the brakes that she says the brakes didn't work. If that's the case, then maybe they don't need to
testify to argument. Sure.
I don't know the state of the law. I don't know in that regard. But I think there's certainly. I think that is working its way through the systems and is something that the labor would never charge. And if you look at federal circuits, there's something that you apply to engineers.
But the Concord didn't sue the defendant.
She's not had that opportunity.
Well, that's what the argument is about asking for to the issue.
But that's my point, Your Honor. We don't know what arguments are going to be made at the time of trial with regard to the issue.
That would be why we're not going to discuss it. We're not going to discuss it.
That'd be my hope, Your Honor. I do not think that the trial court committed an abuse of discretion by enforcing the Rule 11 agreement, sanctioning a party that went around the motion to for evidence that was generated under the auspice of privilege. I do not think that is the law, but that is a discretion. I do not think that should be the law. I think that the word of the game should be denied.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Says clearly that the violation of Rule 11. And number two, the remaining time, can you address why did the court not have an adequate remedy by appeal?
Certainly, Your Honor. The Rule 11 agreement, I understood Mr. Casada say that getting the Kent report in the first instance did not violate the agreement. That the party didn't contemplate the kind of informal investigation that was going on there. What he says violates the Rule 11 agreement. And I wrote this down. He said, serving the subpoena on State Farm. We didn't do that. The way this played out was on February 28th, the court reporting firm issued a subpoena, and it was served on plaintiffs, which is merely their right to receive notice of it. It was not served on State Farm. And when we got the motion to quash, or we got word that, on the second later of the day that the motion to quash was coming, Board told the court reporter, don't serve this on State Farm. Let's see what happens to Mr. Foster. It was eventually, the subpoena was served on State Farm in May, and Rule 11 agreement expired in March. So there's no way that Rule 11 agreement was violated by suing the subpoena on State Farm. It happened 6 weeks after it expired. Adequacy of remedy by appeal, if I may address it briefly, there's two reasons.
should be entitled to maintenance. One is the one I already discussed, that test shouldn't apply to each meal to an order that the Court of Appeals already decided to take up. But even if it did, I think we meet Walker versus Packer on the problem that says if you have a viable defense and it is severely compromised by the trial court's discovery error, that's what we have here. Not some incidental trial ruling that this is not admissible. We have a discovery error. Then your remedy by appeal is not adequate. Separately, in Walker versus Packer, it says the appellate remedy may be adequate if you are denied discovery going to the heart of your case.
Mr. Silas, that's the first time that you've made that argument. You have not made this argument before.
That's not true. Well, I think what Mr. Pissot meant to say was that we attached affidavits to our petition for writ of mandamus in this case that we had not submitted to the trial court for the Court of Appeals. Those affidavits are from our experts, and they say, it's my opinion that the brakes were defined, and the basis for my opinion is the Kemp report, and I'm not aware of any other evidence that I can base my opinion on. So, if I can't base it on the court, I don't have anything to say. That's in essence what those affidavits say. Those affidavits were not submitted below, but we have maintained all along that the Kent report is the most unique piece of evidence in this case. And the reason for that, again, is by the time the court gets to see the car, 2 years after Kent did his work.
I think you already asked a question.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the third cause. We'll take another brief recess.